Chapter 2. Medicine, Conquest of the Catastrophic. An account of technology's frustrations can start anywhere, but sooner or later it leads to medicine. People in the United States and other industrial countries have never been healthier or more anxious about illness. In the 1990s, people described themselves as less healthy than they did in the 1970s, although most medical indicators have been pointing up, not down, with medicine deserving much of the credit. True, concern and even some fear are justified. AIDS and resurging tuberculosis are all too real. Still, medicine is more effective and usually less invasive or painful than it was even a generation ago. But neither refinements of medical technology nor more cautious living habits have brought peace of mind. Escalating costs are but one reason for unhappiness. Ivan Illich's memorable 1976 polemic, Medical Nemesis, found evidence even in mainstream professional journals that medical bureaucracy creates ill health by increasing stress, by multiplying disabling dependents, by generating new painful needs, by lowering the levels of tolerance for discomfort or pain, by reducing the leeway that people are wont to concede to an individual when he suffers, and by abolishing even the right to self-care. Few other critics of medicine have gone so far, yet most have wondered at the paradox, so succinctly put by the political scientist Aaron Wildavsky, that we are doing better but feeling worse. Writers within the medical profession, too, have commented on this irony. The psychiatrist Arthur J. Barsky has pointed out that while medicine is now able to do much more for people, according to one survey in an internal medicine journal, the proportion of treatable major illnesses has increased from under 10% to over 50% since the turn of the century, medical treatment has also focused our attention on symptoms and dangers. People get better medical care than ever. They know more about diet and exercise. They smoke and drink less. By any objective measure, the American middle class is healthier. Yet it is also more concerned about being sick. Is anxiety about health only a mental revenge effect? Have the public and private insurance plans of the industrial world eroded responsibility and rewarded sickness? Have men and women grown neurotic and unappreciative of their medical tutelage, reading fatal portents in every twitch or sniffle, seduced by false hopes of eternal youth and painless ease? Some people do meet this description, having fallen into a health obsession of their own making. Others have learned from the medical system to focus on their symptoms, amplifying them. Behind this worry and discomfort, though, there is a reason, a revenge effect that has to do with one of the most complex systems we know, our own bodies. Medical knowledge has a profound strength but a corresponding weakness. Supported by communication and transportation, it has a superb record of coping with disasters, treating traumatic injury, rehabilitating the bodies of survivors, controlling potentially deadly epidemics of infectious disease. Medical knowledge has also helped engineers save literally millions of lives by improving technologies from water and sewer systems to automobiles. These very accomplishments have had major unintended effects. Thanks to advanced technology, many procedures, while speedier and less invasive, are not always easier to perform. The demands on surgeons' craftsmanship as well as knowledge may be greater. Technological systems also multiply the opportunities for miscalculation and for infection. Above all, as we shall see in the next chapter, the improvement of overall health has made chronic illness more important. Sometimes difficult-to-treat conditions have been the price of survival. Sometimes longer life has meant a sicker life. Before we look at the revenge effects of medicine, it is important to see why medical technology has become as meaningful and as costly as it is. Health without medicine? While many may think of the industrial age as a medical disaster, as a dark fountain of effluents and pollutants, as a purgatory of consumptive operatives in satanic mills, it has also had remarkably positive, unintended consequences, reverse revenge effects. Medical practice has been less important and economic growth more important in increasing the human lifespan than most people realize. True, the great population centers have looked unhealthy and have been unhealthy in many ways. And as the economist and philosopher Amartya Sen has recently pointed out, developing countries today can achieve a remarkably high level of public health even before building an industrial base. Still, the improvement of public health over the last century and a half is as much a consequence of increasing income as it is of scientific medicine. We still don't understand which of the benefits of economic growth really matter to health and how, but we do know that lower rates of death and serious illness have accompanied growth. We are aware, conversely, that illness and mortality grow again when living standards decline. The historical epidemiologist and physician Thomas McCune assembled powerful evidence that deaths from infectious disease began to decline as early as the 18th century. He discovered that airborne disease was in retreat decades before effective vaccines and treatments were available. Tuberculosis in England decreased steadily beginning in the 1830s. 86% of the drop in the tuberculosis death rate took place before streptomycin was introduced in 1947. 68% of the reduction in bronchitis, pneumonia, and influenza deaths, 90% of the decline of whooping cough, and 70% of the decline of scarlet fever and diphtheria occurred before the sulfa drugs appeared in the 1930s. Death rates from water and foodborne diseases, cholera, diarrhea, dysentery, non-respiratory tuberculosis, typhoid, and typhus, also lessened decades before they could be treated, mainly thanks to improved water supplies. There were exceptions. Vaccination has brought the smallpox virus to the brink of extinction. More than 9/10 of the decline in mortality from ear, nose, and throat infections followed the introduction of antibiotics. Still, when McCune considered the impact of specific measures on all airborne diseases, he found that only 25% of the fever deaths occurred after vaccines and therapies were introduced. McCune drew his conclusions mainly from English and Welsh statistics, but American data seemed to confirm them. John B. McKinley, a sociologist, and Sonia M. McKinley, a mathematician, have studied the decline in mortality from infectious diseases and other causes in the United States since 1900. They, too, found that in most cases, effective therapies and vaccines appeared only after most of the easing of the death rate for a given disease had been achieved. In fact, when the proportion of the gross national product devoted to medical care began its sharp ascent in the late 1950s, quote, nearly all, 92% of the modern decline in mortality this century had already occurred, unquote, emphasis in original. Critics of McCune have pointed out the limits of such statistical arguments, which ignore how medical knowledge and medical initiatives worked in the public arena, how physicians supported better urban sanitation, for example, and how special hospitals for tuberculosis patients by the late 19th century slowed the spread of the disease. The statistics also neglect a physician's ability to comfort and to relieve pain and the undisputed power of the placebo effect. Furthermore, they slight the more recent gains that clearly are due to antibiotics and other medication and to diagnostic technology. Even so, the role of medical therapeutics in long-term health remains uncertain. If medicine has done less in combating infectious disease than is usually assumed, what has been responsible for declining mortality? McCune discounts alterations in either microorganisms or people. Too many diseases or people would have had to change at virtually the same time. In any case, by the 18th century, mortality was too low to support the idea that there could have been any natural selection for superior immunity to infection. Nor do better living conditions in themselves explain lower mortality. Declining living standards in early 19th century England did not bring a corresponding large increase in mortality. Certainly, clean water and effective sewage systems curbed cholera and other water and foodborne diseases. But many improvements in food handling, especially widespread pasteurization of milk, were not available to most people until the early 20th century, and by then, gains were already substantial. McCune insists that nutrition is the only remaining explanation for most of the lower death rates for infectious diseases, although he acknowledges a dearth of positive evidence for his argument. Historical information on eating habits is sketchy, and statistical data are too meager to suggest how changes in diet could have improved health, as McCune believes they did. Eating habits depend on culture as much as on income and availability of food, Skeletons from the wealthy ancient Greek colony of Metaponto suggest widespread malnutrition and disease. In Victorian England, even amply fed and well-off parents did not realize how much food growing children need. Pupils went hungry at the best public schools. Another physician historian, Leonard A. Sagan, has challenged the nutrition hypothesis with logic as rigorous as McCune's. Absent actual famine, wartime rationing has generally improved health in the 20th century, putting nations on a forced high-carbohydrate, lower-calorie diet. Grains have replaced saturated fats during food shortages. The most serious food demonstrations in Berlin during the First World War were not about bread, but about the disappearance of butter. Sending food to contemporary developing countries does not always improve death rates, except where mothers and young children have been seriously undernourished, and even for these groups, only modestly. In the 20th century, good nutrition does not appear to have enhanced survival rates in epidemics, including the influenza pandemic of 1918. Sagan argues that something about 19th and 20th century society has made people more resilient and self-confident. Many disease microorganisms are present in individuals who never develop symptoms. Differences in immune response must be the cause. Those who feel in control of their future apparently have stronger immune systems. Literacy and education are better indicators of state of health than is income. In fact, the economist Donald S. Kenkel has discovered that college graduates, regardless of how much they know about health, are significantly less likely to smoke and slightly more likely to exercise than people, regardless of education, who know most about health and behavior. In other words, schooling in general is somehow incrementally more effective in promoting healthful living than specific knowledge about health, and not simply because better educated people are better paid. Conversely, poverty seems to engender a self-destructive fatalism. In Glasgow, Scotland, where in late 1992 one in five residents was unemployed and three out of four received some public assistance, 83% of middle-aged men were regular smokers. Worse yet, one so-called greengrocer's vegetable offerings were limited to marrow-fat processed peas. It is no wonder that cases of scurvy and rickets are still reported, while doctors speculate that depressed immune systems may be responsible for lung cancer rates among smokers in Scotland that are twice those of American smokers. At home, cooking skills often stop at dumping chips in the master fry. We are left with an uncomfortable conclusion about health, and especially about longevity. For all the contributions of medical technology, other things have meant more. The real mechanisms of improved health are so entangled in other good things, the economy, education, environmental quality, that we still don't understand just what has happened. We know, as Aaron Wildowski put it so well, that richer is better. But because we don't understand how and why, it is difficult rationally to say exactly what sorts of public and private applications of money will do most for health. These statistics don't necessarily imply that funds should be shifted from medicine to education, though they may suggest that raiding education programs to pay for health care may have unexpected revenge effects on health itself. Good health turns out to be a positive byproduct of the pursuit of other things. This is a point to which we will return later in examining the implications of revenge effects for the future of medicine. The power of localizing. If the contribution of medicine to longevity and health is harder to measure than we once supposed, it is still real enough. The reason for the profession's success in the last 150 years is no mystery. It was a set of new physical and mental tools that let physicians intervene with an exactness that had once been rare. The view of the organism that prevailed before the 19th century was in many ways an attractive intellectual system. Traditional medicine was like some of today's alternative therapies in viewing the patient as a whole person, but in practice it was not necessarily gentle or humane and had powerful revenge effects of its own. Well into the 18th century, most physicians thought of health as a proper balance of the body's humors, black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm, along with other substances. The often frightful cures visited on the patients of eminent physicians were efforts to reestablish humoral balance. Most people were fortunate in being unable to afford treatment, but the elites who could suffered counterproductive agonies. Doctors and patients both tied pain to gain. Quote, "Gentle purges and slight phlebotomies, bloodlettings, are not my favorites," unquote, declared Samuel Johnson. Quote, "They are popgun batteries which lose time and affect nothing," unquote. Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the American Declaration of Independence, believed with equal firmness in massive bloodletting and purging, for himself and for his patients. He helped promote calomel, a toxic purgative of mercurous chloride. Physicians treated George Washington himself for quinsy, severe streptococcal disease, with large quantities of mercury in his last days. Even medical theorists who tried to localize diseases in particular organs could not escape the tendency to build systems, and bloodletting remained central to the idea of balance in these. As late as 1833, France imported 42 million leeches in a single year for this purpose. Physicians have begun to apply therapeutic leeches again, but on a far smaller scale and with a different theoretical basis. Treating the whole person in this way sometimes had horrific immediate results, but they were not side effects, even when the patient later appeared to improve because of such treatment. The modern idea of the side effect depends on a concept that barely existed in the early 19th century, a focused attack on the site of a problem. This idea, now so commonplace that few physicians or lay people think twice about it, was once heretical. As early as the 17th century, the English clinician Thomas Sydenham had awakened interest in diseases as distinctive entities, but the 18th century lacked the science and technology to draw meaningful distinctions. The discomfort and even danger from bleeding, purging, and mercury compounds were no mere painful inconveniences, but part of the healing process, proof that the cure was working. Many people administered these cures to themselves and their families. And whatever the results were called, 19th century remedies could be as harrowing as aggressive 20th century chemotherapy. The virtuoso Niccolo Paganini, treated with mercury for suspected syphilis, lost his teeth to the spread of an infection. He suffered severe coughing spells, failing eyesight, and a collapse of his confidence and ambition, all due to the mercury treatment. Instruments of localization. 19th and 20th century doctors gained their power, prestige, and wealth by persuading patients to accept more and more localized diagnoses and treatments. They developed new techniques to isolate and attack diseases, mainly acute ones. Movements that resisted the trend, from Christian Science to chiropractic, promoted their own visions of healing the whole person, but they remained marginal. Localization did not always produce better results than the older medical alternatives it replaced, at least at first. The stethoscope, first used in an elementary form by the French physician René Laennec in 1816, required special training to yield more meaningful information than old-fashioned auscultation. But the idea of the stethoscope was as important as the results it yielded. It pinpointed conditions that were once considered more diffusely. The inventor of a binaural stethoscope wrote in 1851, "As certain nebulae are resolved into stars by powerful telescopes, so specific chest sounds, obscure from their lowness, may be determined." In the same year, the German physician and physicist Hermann von Helmholtz introduced that other canonical medical instrument, the ophthalmoscope. By letting a trained observer see the detailed structure of the retina, it also permitted an earlier and more accurate detection of illness. And 100 years ago, the discovery of X-radiation by the German physicist Wilhelm Röntgen appeared to do for the entire body what the ophthalmoscope had done for the eye. In 1918, the American physician James B. Herrick showed that an electrocardiogram, especially in the presence of certain symptoms, could identify the existence and location of a coronary artery occlusion, a condition more common than doctors had realized. What the stethoscope, ophthalmoscope, and the thermometer did for examination, the microscope and related devices like the microtome did for laboratory analysis. Compound microscopes had existed since the 17th century, but distortion limited their utility. Only around 1830 was there a breakthrough leading to a new way of correcting aberrations in microscope lenses. It soon led to instruments of unprecedented power. Quote, "To resolve," as one reviewer put it, the solid products of disease into the simplicity of their elementary components, unquote. The technological transformation of medicine was due both to the deployment of new devices and to their cultural consequences. The new instruments revolutionized the ways doctors saw, heard, and thought, and in turn changed the attitude of patients toward their physicians as well as their own bodies. Listening to chest sounds and interpreting x-rays demand practice in finding or creating patterns where naive observers would find ambiguity. Patients wanted, and still want, this ability to specify and localize. Some doctors abuse technological enthusiasm for their own profit, but it is demand that lets them do it. Even before 1830, patients suspected doctors who had not adopted the stethoscope. X-rays were an international sensation of popular culture in the late 1890s. People with foreign objects lodged in their bodies, even those who suffered no pain from them, now asked to have them extracted, a procedure that sometimes had fatal complications. Localization, too, could and can have revenge effects. Localizing surgery. Once acute illness had been identified specifically, it could be targeted. In the 1840s, the American dentists Horace Greene and William Morton demonstrated the surgical possibilities of nitrous oxide and ether, two gases previously best known as recreational drugs. As the number of general and local anesthetics grew, opportunities for surgery multiplied. Antisepsis and asepsis reduced its risks sharply. But critics of medicine point out a revenge effect of anesthesia. By making the immediate surgical intervention less painful, it has encouraged surgery and, if such things are quantifiable, possibly increased the sum of medically induced pain, especially post-operatively. This argument takes no account of the pain, not to mention death and debility, that naturally resulted and would still result from not having surgery. Much surgery has been what Lewis Thomas has called halfway technology, prolonging life and relieving discomfort at great cost without treating the cause of pathology itself. On the other hand, localization makes many kinds of surgery far less invasive. Indeed, imaging often renders surgery unnecessary. In the mid-19th century, one hallmark of surgical skill was the speed of an amputation. In the late 20th, it is the fineness of an incision. When the editor of the scientific journal Nature, John Maddox, had a cartilage removed from his knee in the early 1960s, it was open surgery. Recovery took several months. His surgeon performed a repeat operation in 1991 with arthroscopy, in which a light source, a miniature camera, and a video recorder permit the whole procedure to be completed through three small holes. Maddox spent a single day in the hospital, then took a taxi to work. Localizing pharmacy. Like diagnostic instruments, drugs targeted for particular ailments are a late 19th century innovation following the germ theory of disease. In the early 19th century, doctors classified drugs by their effect on the whole body. Terms like cathartic, diuretic, and narcotic survive from this vocabulary. Dosage depended not only on the drug's unusual effects, but on the patient's constitution and even the local climate. Prescribing a single drug uniquely for a certain condition was the mark of a quack. Specific drugs were slow to arrive. At first, specificity was a matter of degree. Progressively, new chemical knowledge produced increasingly effective substances from familiar natural remedies. In 1804, Armand Sagan obtained morphine from opium, and by the 1840s, doctors were able to inject it with hypodermic needles. In 1822, quinine was derived from the cruder quinquina bark, a giant step in the treatment of malaria. These new drugs were more focused versions of the old. It was chemical synthesis in the late 19th century that made specific medicine possible. It was only 100 years ago, in 1890, that Paul Ehrlich advanced the side-chain theory that a drug can act by binding to specific kinds of cells as a key fits a lock and neutralizing them. The next 2 decades saw specific treatments for diphtheria, tetanus, and syphilis. In 1910, Ehrlich was able to introduce salvarsan, a drug that identified and attacked syphilis spirochetes while sparing the body's own cells, the first magic bullet, in Ehrlich's own phrase. The sulfa drugs of the 1930s, penicillin and streptomycin in the 1940s, the polio vaccines of the 1950s, and the other celebrated drugs of the middle years of the 20th century, all excited doctors and patients alike as few other scientific discoveries. Meanwhile, governments in the United States and elsewhere were suppressing the remaining patent medicine tonics, discredited vestiges of the time when treating the whole body was the norm. Technology has been developing for over 150 years toward just this kind of localization. New generations of instruments have changed the nature of medical training. Although the goal of established medicine, perhaps even more in America than elsewhere, has been a measured, speedy, and precise application of a pharmaceutical or device, the ideal of precision is far from realized. Nonetheless, it is what distinguishes our medicine from the treatments of 150 years ago. Then, patients expected medication to restore the balance of their humors. Now they want not only a precise diagnosis of their condition, but an equally precise remedy for it. Half the doctors interviewed in a survey by the American Medical Association in 1989 believed their patients were requesting unnecessary treatment. Were the patients indeed worried sick, or were they instead desperate for relief from conditions for which there is no localized therapy? The chronic conditions we will see in the next chapter. Mastering the urgent. If medicine showed how the understanding of specific mechanisms could produce effective therapies for acute illness, the development of surgery showed that the more acute and serious an emergency, the more impressive the rescue and rehabilitation that were possible. The rise of emergency treatment has demonstrated once more the power of a positive revenge effect. As new munitions, vehicles, and industries made both military and civilian injuries more severe, the techniques of emergency medicine responded. Technology showed its power to deal with the sudden and the life-threatening. The history of military medicine is worth studying in detail because it is the best documented long-term record of the ability of medicine to treat casualties. It also shows one of the happiest unexpected benefits of technology, how military carnage eventually came to the aid of civilian surgery. At least until the time of the American Civil War, military surgery had been a craft, sometimes skillfully exercised, but little improved over the centuries. The military historian Richard Holmes has written that a Macedonian phalangist, treated for a sword cut received when Alexander beat the Persians at Arbela in 331 BC, probably had a better chance of avoiding gangrene than a British soldier whose similar wound was quickly bandaged by his regimental surgeon before Sebastopol in 1854. Well into the 19th century, infections rather than wounds themselves were the real hazards of battle. During the American War of Independence, American troops suffered a 2% battle casualty rate. Meanwhile, 75% of those treated in hospitals did not survive. Disease, most of it unrelated to wounds, caused 9 out of 10 fatalities. Still, the toll on the battlefield was increasing. In the middle decades of the 19th century, what William H. McNeill has called the Industrial Revolution of War brought unprecedented combat deaths. Supply and troop trains, smokeless propellants, breech-loading rifles, armor-piercing artillery, and vast conscript armies began to define war as it was known through most of the 20th century. One result was staggering numbers of wounded as well as dead troops. The new technology changed the hazards of warfare more in the generation of the 1850s and 1860s than in the previous 150 years. Although epidemics were still more dangerous than enemy action, the Minier bullet and rifled barrel, widely used by the French and Russians, made infantry fire 7 times deadlier and produced wounds far more extensive than older ammunition of comparable size. In the Crimean War, the Russian army lost a higher proportion of its troops per year in battle, and the French lost a higher proportion to disease than in any previously recorded war. The death rate per 1,000 per year was over 253 for the French, 161 for the British, and 119 for the Russians. Propelled by the new Springfield .58 rifle, the Minier bullet proved especially devastating in the American Civil War. The new firepower was massed, just as the inaccurate and slow-reloading muskets of the 17th and 18th centuries had been. Nearly 30,000 of the over 174,000 gunshot wounds to the arms and legs of Union troops led to amputation. The U.S. Patent Office recorded dozens of new designs to meet the demand for artificial limbs. The new intensity of casualties inspired impressive gains in treatment. Surgeons learned more effective use of ligatures. The mortality rate from wound infection fell from up to 60% early in the war to 3% at its end. Infectious disease still caused most military deaths. One estimate is that 110,000 Union and 94,000 Confederate troops died of wounds, whereas 250,000 and 164,000 succumbed to disease. Although military medicine and sanitation do not seem to have been any more effective than their civilian counterparts, antiseptic technique and other surgical innovations began to change that. The First and Second World Wars, despite vastly greater total fatalities, actually had fewer deaths, combat and disease-related, per thousand troop years than the Crimean War and the U.S. Civil War. By the end of the First World War, for example, better treatment improved the death rate to 8% of the wounded, down from 20% in the Crimean War and 13.3% in the Civil War. Yet, in other ways, wounds became more severe. Higher velocity ammunition and fragmentation weapons multiplied the chances of disfiguring injury, but this also had a reverse revenge effect. The First World War was a milestone for the emerging specialties of orthopedic surgery and plastic and reconstructive surgery for civilian as well as military patients. The Second World War revealed how effective the medical response to urgent problems had become. Under wartime pressure, the production of penicillin increased in a single year from just enough for 100 patients to the billions of units needed for Allied casualties after D-Day. In the Second World War, and even more in the Korean War and Vietnam War, increasingly rapid responses cut death rates. The Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, MASH units of Korea, saw the median wait of wounded soldiers for treatment reduced to 1.5 hours. 55% of wounded troops were hospitalized on the same day they were wounded. American field medicine in Vietnam did even more for emergency treatment, civilian as well as combat. Only decades earlier, a soldier wounded in New Guinea needed 16 native bearers for transportation, with the nearest military hospital in Australia. The average soldier needed medical assistance for malaria 4 times a year. In the Vietnam jungles, however, helicopters with medically trained crews were able to bring most seriously wounded soldiers to surgery less than 2 hours after the event. The flight itself took no more than half an hour. Only 2.5% of those arriving alive at the hospital failed to survive, and an unprecedented 87% of the hospitalized wounded were able to return to duty. A wounded soldier in the Second World War had a 71% chance of survival, in Korea, 74%, and in Vietnam, 81%. From the horse-drawn ambulances of the Napoleonic Wars to the litter jeeps of the Second World War and the medevac Huey helicopters of Vietnam, medical technology has been most dramatically effective when injury has been most severe and has needed the most prompt attention. Moreover, the results have not been of military importance alone. Warfare has always been a laboratory for extreme situations. The military has been able to mobilize resources, as in the development and commercial production of penicillin in the Second World War, at a pace that civilian market economies cannot match. But it has galvanized research and practice for certain problems, injuries and infections of young men and women carefully screened for good health. Military medicine has been care at its most acute. The emergence of emergency, civilian accidents and epidemics. Civilian medicine has shown the same attention to urgency, the same alternation of destruction and repair. Like military treatment, civilian practice was forced to respond to 19th and early 20th century technology, which has tended to expose people in unprecedented concentrations to sudden and violent forces. Train, and later automobile and aircraft crashes, theater fires, industrial explosions, and accidents. By the mid-19th century, A charitable appeal in Philadelphia drew attention to the rising number of industrial mishaps. Accident admissions to the city's Pennsylvania hospital, for example, increased from 140 to 400 annually in the 20 years after 1827. To these, the 20th century added many more, including automotive accidents. With new antiseptic procedures, X-rays and other imaging, blood typing and antibiotics, emergency medicine has flourished in the last 100 years. Its story, unlike that of military medicine, remains to be told, partly because it was a neglected and usually low-status specialty until its rapid rise in prestige during the 1970s and 1980s. Late in the 20th century, the ability of emergency medical crews to respond to disaster reached levels hard to imagine only decades earlier. Spinal cord injuries that once meant irreversible paralysis can now be treated with the synthetic steroid methylprednisolone, or MP, soon after an accident to reduce inflammation and cell damage from free radicals. In 1993, the former New York Jets lineman, Dennis Byrd, was able to walk again less than a year after breaking his neck. Another prominent example of recovery from catastrophe shows even more dramatically how well hospital-based medicine can respond to extreme conditions. In January 1993, a gunman shot 5 people at close range outside the Langley, Virginia headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency. 2 died immediately, and another was treated for minor injuries. The fate of other victims was revealing. 1 60-year-old CIA employee was flown by helicopter to a local hospital where an operating team had been alerted. A bullet, after passing through the bone and blood vessels of one arm, was lodged in his chest. He had lost so much blood that, as the head of the hospital trauma unit put it, the man had 1 foot on a banana peel and the other on the edge of a precipice. In Vietnam, where the hospital's trauma service director had served, the injury would have meant amputation or even death. Treatment required almost 12 hours of surgery. The hospital, calling for donors of the patient's unusual O-negative blood type, promptly found 450 people who contributed blood for him and others. It was not only the skills of surgeons, anesthesiologists, and nurses that saved the patient's life and arm, it was speedy evacuation and communication. New weaponry multiplies emergencies and makes them more severe, but faster evacuation and better life support systems rise to the occasion. Yes, it is tragic that these systems and skills are necessary. Many people would gladly trade some of them for a society that needed them less often. The point is, bloodshed has had an unexpected and unintended positive side. Just as warfare, transportation, and industry were increasing the number of casualties, surging world trade and population movements were accelerating another acute problem, the national and international circulation of infectious disease. They made it easier to define the situation as urgent when actually it was still relatively small. In 1875, in the midst of worldwide concern over the spread of rabies, the death rate in Great Britain was still 2 per million of population. But published statistics revealed that the rate had risen more than sixfold, from 0.3 per million in only 15 years. Expanded shipping was transferring rabid animals to and from the New World and Asia. Rabid dogs were even more frightening in growing cities than they had been in the countryside. Louis Pasteur's controversial trials of human rabies vaccine in 1885 and his successful vaccination of thousands of exposed individuals showed how well the specificity of medicine could be mobilized in a crisis. Pasteur had identified the virus responsible for rabies, as well as the sites of the disease, the brain, and nervous system. He became an international hero by providing a specific response to an urgent situation. Even in the absence of vaccines, medical knowledge and communication technologies have helped to prevent the worst consequences of infection. In the early 20th century, there was still no effective treatment for bubonic plague. There was also a great reservoir of the plague bacillus in Asia, where political and military upheavals in China helped to increase its range. The plague, as William H. McNeill has pointed out, could have devastated North America and Europe. It killed 6 million people in India alone in the decade after its arrival in Bombay in 1898. between 1346 and 1350 alone, 20 million out of a total of 100 million Europeans were lost in the Great Dying, or Great Pestilence, as it was originally called. Earlier, slower ocean voyages protected overseas populations by exhausting the supply of hosts, uninfected fleas, rats, and people. Late 19th century steamers, with their higher speeds and greater capacity, made the establishment of new plague reservoirs more likely. Worse yet, the United States, South America, and other regions have burrowing rodents that can form permanent reservoirs. Against great odds, international cooperation checked the disaster in most parts of the world. The plague bacillus, Yersinia pestis, was discovered in 1894 by Japanese and French bacteriologists working independently. As scientists studied the spread of the bacillus, they learned enough about its mechanisms to permit effective quarantine. But while such public health measures stopped the spread of the disease, they did not do so for the bacillus, which increased its range well into the 20th century. Ranchers in the American West inadvertently gave it a free ride when they tried to eradicate prairie dog colonies by introducing sick animals. The result was a memorable revenge effect of the resurging variety. There were just as many prairie dogs, but now infected ones. In 1940, 34 species of burrowing rodents and 35 species of fleas in the United States had become plague carriers, thanks in part to the ranchers' efforts. In spite of the spread of the plague, the remarkable fact is how little dread was left. In 1992 alone, at least 10 cases were reported in the United States. One man in Arizona died from pneumonic plague after handling an infected domesticated cat he had removed from the crawl space of a house. The measures taken show the changes to an ancient threat. Authorities dusted the house and nearby rodent burrows with an insecticide against fleas. They dusted the cats and dogs in the house. They advised the owners to continue periodic dusting. The medical professionals who had treated the man tested negative. Of these, only two nurses requested and received preventive treatment with tetracycline. The Centers for Disease Control did issue a warning to veterinarians that animals on the West Coast and in the Southwest were at risk, but the level of alarm was notably low compared to fears that risk factors for other chronic illness raised, including asbestos and toxic waste exposure. What changed the plague from the most dreaded disease of the West to merely a localized hazard? The immediate answer is that there are now fewer reservoirs of rodents interacting with concentrated human populations. A long-term explanation, probably, is that a less virulent form of the plague bacillus has spread over the centuries, immunizing both animal and human hosts against the deadlier form. Fortunately, the immunity of much of the world at the turn of the last century did not have to be tested. Bacteriologists of the early 1890s were finally able to identify the bacterium responsible for the plague and the mechanism of transmission, and this specific knowledge made intervention effective against catastrophe. Once the problem was localized, both therapy and prevention could also be targeted. Of course, there are limits to our protection, especially against rapidly mutating viral infections. A generation after Western nations were able to raise effective barriers to the plague, pandemic influenza struck in 1918, causing up to 40 million deaths worldwide, nearly 200,000 of which were in the United States. Today's communications and biomedical technology make it possible to formulate a new influenza vaccine every year after determining the most likely new RNA mutations that would render previous immunizations ineffective. It is true that mass immunization has risks of its own. In 1976, 1,000 people developed the paralytic disease Guillain-Barré syndrome after an American program of mass immunization against a swine flu epidemic that was anticipated to have the potential of the 1918 disaster. This does not change the fact that medical technology, on balance, has been a powerful force against biological catastrophe. Better a vaccine without an epidemic than an epidemic without a vaccine, as one vaccination advocate put it later. Just as boiler explosions, railroad crashes, automobile accidents, lethal munitions, and other 19th and early 20th century innovations motivated new treatments for the victims of catastrophe, the international spread of infectious disease by improved transportation helped produce more effective means of prevention and treatment. Paradoxes of Vigilance and Craft. Critics of medicine have found in cases like swine flu a distressing increase in the rate of iatrogenic, physician-caused disease, of side effects worse than the symptoms, if not the actual diseases they are intended to treat. Some might consider these the main revenge effects of medicine, and iatrogenic diseases are in fact an important problem. But are they true revenge effects? It is worth keeping in mind that the concept of a side effect depends on the ideal of modern medicine that we have just traced. Targeted, localized, measured interventions with effects that can be verified with controls. In practice, doctors have still not studied the outcomes of many medical procedures rigorously. Some accepted ones, on closer scrutiny, undoubtedly will turn out to be ineffective or even counterproductive. Some controversial treatments will be vindicated. But almost everyone agrees on the principle of weighing benefits against risks in statistically sound trials. And this is a relatively new concept in medical history. Medical writers have long recognized malpractice. Many recognize that improper drugs can cause or worsen disease. But the localization of medicine has brought a different notion of medically caused pain and harm. When medicine was supposed to treat the whole body, disruption could signify effectiveness. Medicine was expected to be bitter and painful. It was quacks who introduced sugared pills, as the medical historians Roy and Dorothy Porter have pointed out. Patients like Samuel Johnson and Paganini expressed the logic of pre-modern medicine in their positive view of the suffering their treatment brought. Medical technology and its discontents. The real revenge effects of medical localization and faith in objective measurement are more subtle than futile procedures. As the physician and medical historian Stanley Joel Reiser has noted, there is a hierarchy of medical evidence, with tests and imaging results at the top, the physician's direct visual and oral examination in the middle, and the patient's account of illness at the bottom. Doctors and patients alike have sought both objective and localized diagnosis, as well as specific treatment. Yet neither professionals nor laypeople have been satisfied. Doctors want the prestige and higher fees that come with advanced procedures, but not the government regulation and insurance bureaucracy that expensive treatment entails. And they fear, probably rightly, that computerized norms will rob them of professional discretion and initiative. Patients sometimes demand unproven technology or therapies from a conservative or skeptical profession, but they also resent impersonality. And they believe, correctly, that in learning to interpret technologically produced data, doctors have failed to remember the skills of looking, touching, and listening. When all tests are negative, in the presence of painful symptoms, is the problem a virus or other chronic disease not yet detectable, or is the complaint psychological? An over-reliance on tests can also defeat medical common sense. A Stanford pre-medical student wrote movingly of 4 weeks of horrific tests before doctors in the university hospital finally acknowledged that a ruptured retrocecal appendix was the cause of his agonizing stomach pains. A retired physician and family friend had recognized the symptoms at once, but the young doctors trusted tests above traditional judgment. It isn't hard to draw up lists of drugs, treatments, and procedures that many or most physicians consider doubtful or bad. Cases fill weighty textbooks, like Robert H. Moser's Diseases of Medical Progress, general interest treatments like Illich's Medical Nemesis, and Diana Dutton's Worse Than the Disease, not to mention the tabloid press. It takes a high degree of medical and statistical knowledge to evaluate the merits of most cases. Learning from mistakes is inevitable, although too much professional and popular skepticism about new therapies could obviously result in corresponding revenge effects. Just as many people seem to demand aggressive treatment as fear it. Probably the most fundamental revenge effects of contemporary medicine are systematic tendencies, not the dead ends and errors of therapeutics. The problem of today's medicine, and main revenge effect of new therapies, is that contrary to our expectations of technology, the more advanced it becomes, the more it demands in vigilance and craftsmanship. Elsewhere, we expect, generally incorrectly as we shall see, that more advanced technology will bring more safeguards against things going wrong, less need for attention, and fewer workers with craft knowledge. In medicine, the increased potential hazards of diagnostic and therapeutic equipment, complex procedures, and the possible interactions of drugs require an unusual degree of attention. The proof is the surprising frequency of serious errors in medical practice. A group of Harvard researchers studied over 30,000 randomly selected records from 51 acute care hospitals in New York State from 1984. Internists and surgeons from outside the hospitals coded treatments and outcomes. The study concluded that 3.7% of all hospital stays include at least one adverse event. Of these, more than half resulted from some physician error. Medical negligence injured one patient in 100. Judged by the risks of everyday life, a 3.7% mishap and 1.0% incompetence rate are high, and the more people are attracted to the medical system, the more casualties even a low rate of substandard care will cause. The authors projected nearly 100,000 adverse effects, over 27,000 with negligence, among 2,670,000 patients discharged from New York hospitals. Over 6,300 people were permanently impaired, and over 13,400 died, all needlessly. At a symposium in 1992, Lucian L. Leap, one of the project leaders, estimated that almost one American hospital patient in 25, or 1.3 million each year, suffers an adverse effect, and that one in 400, or 100,000, dies. This does not include unpredictable events like allergic reactions or risks of properly followed established procedures like cancer chemotherapy. If Leap's estimate is correct, avoidable medical injuries take twice as many lives as highway accidents. Here is a repeating effect. Improvements in treatment encourage more people to undergo procedures. More advanced technology may produce better results when all goes well, but because there are more interacting systems, more things can go wrong, a recomplicating effect. As their numbers multiply and as the population ages, even a small rate of error and malpractice can produce shocking casualties. A single hospital might dispense over 2.8 million drug doses each year, based on Leap's example, wherein each of 24,000 patients received 10 medications twice a day during an average 6-day stay. Even an error rate of less than 0.2% would result in 5,000 pharmaceutical mistakes and perhaps 500 adverse events. The point is not only that there is much more malpractice than ever reaches the courts, probably in other Western countries as well as the United States, but that avoiding serious error requires greater attention on the part of physicians, surgeons, nurses, and technicians, and increasingly of computer programmers and software developers. Software can injure and kill not only by failing to signal dangerous conditions, but by triggering the delivery of too much or too little medication, or by sending too many false alarms. Glitches in computer-controlled radiation dosage can be fatal. Automated treatment may decrease catastrophic risk to patients, but it imposes a need for more safeguards, more attention, and more stress. Technologically intense medicine is, to use Charles Perrow's term again, a tightly coupled system and often a complex one. With proper training, supervision, and peer review, it can provide a high level of benefit, but it also increases the chances for problems like unwanted interactions of one medication with another. Burdens of craft. Consider laparoscopy, a form of surgery that appears much neater and less traumatic than conventional procedures. Laparoscopic surgeons manipulate fiber optic light sources and cameras and insert miniaturized instruments into the body through a few small incisions. Patients recover in days rather than weeks. The procedure, which originated in the late 1980s in community hospitals rather than in academic medical centers, became so popular that by 1991, it accounted for 400,000 of 600,000 gallbladder removals. Yet financially, it has disappointed health insurers. According to one study, although it cost 25% less than conventional techniques, the rate of gallbladder surgery increased by 50% in one health maintenance organization, raising total expenditures on gallbladder care by 11%. People whose discomfort was only mild and who might otherwise have avoided the pain and lost income from surgery as long as possible instead find the new style procedure attractive. But the real revenge effect of laparoscopy has turned out to be a medical rather than a financial one. After all, both surgeons and HMO patients have benefited materially, even if the insurers have not. Unfortunately, for all its apparent tidiness, laparoscopy may be more hazardous than conventional surgery, a recomplicating effect. Complications may occur up to 10 times more often than with traditional procedures, in as many as 1 case in 50. A television image is narrower, grainier, and of course flatter than the immediate, if messy, sight of an open abdomen. Surgeons can't feel internal organs directly with their fingers. To perform what critics have called Nintendo surgery requires skills different from those for traditional procedures, different enough that some surgeons with the right spatial motor abilities are proficient after a few supervised operations, while others are said to need dozens or even hundreds. New York State demands at least 15 supervised operations before permitting solo laparoscopy. Far from making work surer for the surgeon, the new equipment demands mental and physical contortions in virtual space. Will a future generation of surgeons, growing up with video games and other flattened mappings of the world, learn a new way of relating to the body, as their predecessors learned to interpret stethoscope sounds, microscopic images, and X-rays? Or will a gradual loss of some older tactile skills impoverish medicine? Since there will always be times when advanced procedures can't be used, a hospital may lack appropriate equipment, the procedures may pose unacceptable risks in a specific case, surgeons probably need training in both new and traditional techniques. Instead of simplifying the medical curriculum, speedier procedures may, in the long run, add to it, a recomplicating effect. Stanley Joel Reiser has called attention to the dangers of inputting more validity to objective test reports and imaging than to a physician's own observations and the patient's own account of illness. We have already seen how the shift from tool use to tool management enhances our power over the physical world while reducing immediacy of understanding. The case of laparoscopy, at least so far, shows that the management of new tools can be a craft in its own right and not an easy one to master. Other technologies may be dangerous ways of gathering additional information. Catheterization is one of the most controversial. Inserting tubes in patients' bodies for monitoring bodily functions appeals to the physician's desire for information. Working with more precise information enhances professional prestige. Yet results are still inconclusive. Few specialists agree with the charge of Eugene D. Robin and Robert F. McCauley, professors of medicine at Stanford, that up to 100,000 patients have died from the use of pulmonary artery catheters, as many of the patients were at high risk. But the procedure remains contested. The risks include infections, perforations, arterial ruptures, thrombosis, and heart blocks. Many physicians have not learned to insert the catheter, calibrate it, or interpret the data gathered with it. The catheter, Robin and McCauley conclude, is, quote, user-friendly, even though it may be UZ-unfriendly, unquote. The point is not when, if ever, catheterization is worth the pain and risks. It is that this additional source of information makes decisions more difficult for physicians, if only because they need to decide whether or not to use the technique in the first place. It takes more skill to be a patient, to learn something about the procedure and to discuss it knowledgeably with the doctor. Burdens of vigilance. At the other end of the spectrum, far removed from the skills of advanced surgery, are fatiguing, repetitive, and familiar low-technology duties that the pressure of working with new systems makes it easy but dangerous to ignore. Elementary sanitation is one. About 6% of all hospital patients are infected by microbes they encounter upon entering the hospital. Medical personnel transmit many of these infections. Some doctors and nurses may be asymptomatic carriers, transmitting bacteria by merely breathing or walking around. But a far simpler problem, inadequate hand washing, probably causes more complications. A study at the University of Iowa Hospital showed how the pressures of work could displace even this most basic and valuable routine. Investigators studying hand cleaning preparations found to their dismay that fewer than half of intensive care personnel, even when aware of the observers, washed their hands at all. Experts in infection control coax, cajole, threaten, and plead, but still their colleagues neglect to wash their hands, a New England Journal of Medicine editorial lamented. Doctors appear even more negligent than other staff about washing before examining patients, and not just in America. A professor of clinical hygiene in Freiburg, Germany, Dr. Frank Daschner, once infuriated his colleagues by declaring, quote, "You can sit on any toilet seat without the least risk, but don't, whatever you do, shake hands with your doctor," unquote. And he stood by the proposition in 1990. Advanced technology, far from banishing the rituals of the past, makes them even more crucial by multiplying the possibilities of infection. Medicine also imposes another need for vigilance. The interpretation of life-critical test results is in the hands not only of medical specialists, but of inadequately trained and supervised technicians. Some tests can be automated and even digitized, but all too often the recognition of dangerous conditions depends not on science, but on skills that vary with innate ability and practice. The Pap test for cancer has saved many women's lives, but when misinterpreted to give false reassurance, as it often is, it can be a risk to life. There are risks in false positive diagnosis, too. The twin burdens of new competence and added vigilance help explain why medical costs are so difficult to control. The costs in themselves are not revenge effects. They may or may not be worth the benefits received. But multiplying medications and treatments increases the risk of possible unwanted interactions. Our discontent with medicine is not merely a psychological trick we are playing on ourselves, nor is it, at the other extreme, a reaction against medically caused illness. The exploding worldwide demand for medical services shows, to the contrary, how much the power of technologically based medicine is appreciated. But we have to consider the nature and limits of this power more closely. Technology has benefited human longevity more by raising the standard of living than by raising the standards of healing, though this does not mean that medicine has not counted. Medicine was transformed beginning in the early 19th century when physicians turned from treating the whole system to identifying specific diseases with specific remedies. At the same time, the rising toll of warfare and industrial accidents was helping raise the level of military and emergency medicine. The threat of worldwide epidemics was mobilizing medical authorities in Europe and North America. Of course, catastrophic injury, acute illness, and infection had not really been mastered. The influenza pandemic of 1918 and the casualties of two world wars demonstrated this all too well. What the developers of medical technologies had left beyond doubt was that the search for more targeted treatment of acute conditions and for more precise surgical procedures was prolonging lives. Many people would say that the revenge effects of the new techniques were injuries and deaths from unsuccessful procedures, the side effects of therapies and vaccines. But patients as well as physicians are ready to accept risks. In fact, as the study of Leap and his colleagues showed, the great majority of avoidable medical errors go unnoticed. The real revenge effect is on the practice of medicine itself. We expect technological refinement to reduce dependence on human attention, and it often does. Automobiles and even commercial jet aircraft have fewer gauges to be watched than they did a generation ago. Paved roads actually need less maintenance than dirt ones. But because the human body is a tightly coupled system in which treatments can make parts interact in unexpected ways, advanced medicine usually requires more rather than less human attention. More and more care becomes intensive, potential complications multiply, and deviations can be fatal. For physicians, new technology requires more rather than less craft. For all health workers, it demands more rather than less vigilance. Medicine costs as much as it does not simply because machines are so expensive, but because successful medical technology multiplies the need for non-technological services. And what of the other sources of medical discontent that were mentioned at the beginning of this chapter? Many of them arise from another and more troublesome revenge effect of medical improvement, the shift from acute to chronic illness.